Hey, are you curious about how many widowed folks there are in Henderson or in Chester County? There is a website you can go to find out a lot of interesting information about communities. Henderson, Tennessee, this is censusreporter.org is what it's called. It's a website that journalists or media people will go to before they go and do a story or an interview at a certain location. This is the report from censusreporter.org. Henderson, Tennessee, population 6,326. There are almost 2,000 households in Henderson. 23% of those households are female householders. I was shocked when I saw that stat. That means there's no adult male in that household. 23% of the households in Henderson, Tennessee are female householders. If you were to get all the females 15 years and older, now, I don't know why in the world the Census Bureau considers a 15-year-old an adult, but they do. Okay, now, if you were to get all the females 15 years and older in Henderson, Tennessee together, 13% of them are widowed. What if we could raise that number instead of 15 and older, 20 and older? Imagine how much higher that percentage would be than 13%. In Chester County, population over 17,000, there are over 6,000 households. 11% of the females, 11% of the females 15 years and older in Chester County, Tennessee, are widowed. 2% of the males. Now, what that all means is you're talking about approximately 1,000. 1,000 widowed people in Chester County, Tennessee. And you know who's ministering to them or offering to minister to them? This church family right here, the Wings program. If you attend that Wings program, I want to challenge you to use this ministry as an opportunity to introduce people to Jesus and His church. It's an outreach. There are people in the community, in the county, who really have not been shown special love or compassion, some of them not even by their own family, because their own family doesn't understand, doesn't know. But you do. And if we can get our widowed folks and those who are working in the widowhood ministry to encourage widowed people from the community to come, maybe we can help even bring them closer to the Lord. Probably some of the greatest encouragement that my family has received is reports from churches who have had conversions as a result of people being introduced to Jesus through the widowhood ministry. In Villarica, Georgia, I think we've had 4. And in Stantonville, Tennessee, they have had a conversion. We helped Joseph Eshin in Ghana, a young man who wanted to start a widowhood ministry. And within the first 12 months of him launching that ministry in Ghana, there were, I think, 9 different women who became Christians. When we show compassion to people who are struggling with a unique life circumstance that are basically being neglected and ignored by a lot of people, it's amazing how much influence you can have with them in regard to helping them with the most important thing in their life, and that's their relationship with Jesus. What's it like to be widowed? There was a book that caught my eye when I was married. I used to brag about the fact I had more mall mileage on my pedometer than any man on planet Earth. My wife loved to go to malls. Now, she didn't spend a lot, but for some reason, I think it was the smell of clearance tags, I think is what did it. But I did a lot of time in malls. I ran across this book and I had to get it. It's written by Carl D. Mills. It's called How to Go Shopping with Your Wife and Enjoy It. A book like that I needed, so I bought that. It's a discussion of marital adjustment. Now, in that book, Brother Mills points this out. Each one of us lives inside of his or her own skin. No one can get inside there with us. We are all alone, and no one knows what we are experiencing inside. The only way someone can know what we are experiencing is for us to convey a message to them, letting them know. Let me suggest that you never say this to anybody, especially a widowed person. Don't ever say, And I mean this universally. Don't ever say, I know how you feel, because you do not. There is no way that you could know how they feel. Even if you've been through a similar type situation, you do not know how they feel. People are different. People react to circumstances and experiences differently. What is it like to be widowed? Let me just share with you from the mouth of widowed folks. Imagine a single event that will dramatically change your calendar, your checkbook, your friendship network, the contents of your refrigerator, the temperature you set your thermostat, your outlook on your future, your connection with your children, and that's not all. Your appearance may change, your emotions, your sleep patterns, your theology, your social status, and possibly even your address, where you get your mail. I experienced most of these and more beginning April 21, 2006, the day I became a widow. I don't like that word, and I still will not check that box to identify myself. Man, she's touchy. But for a good reason. Let me ask you to look at widowhood differently. A lot of times, I kind of get the sense that people who are widowed almost feel ashamed, reluctant at least, at the very least, to admit that that's their marital status. Let me suggest to you a different perspective. I shared this story with the widowed folks that we had a luncheon with yesterday over at Wallace Gano Dining Hall. Her name is Betty. Betty and Jim knew one another when they were kids. They ended up getting married. Jim went off to the military. He was dismissed from the military because of a medical issue. Jim's health deteriorated pretty bad. He was a teacher after he left the military, and then he also started preaching, and he got pretty pitiful with his health. His health tanked pretty bad. As a matter of fact, so bad that the only way he could get around was a wheelchair, and his wife wheeled him around everywhere he went. Old Jim, he would preach up in the Wheeling, West Virginia area, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, East Liverpool, Ohio, up there in what we call the Upper Ohio Valley. Everywhere he went, she took him there. Now, she's a high school English teacher. That woman is still teaching high school English at Weir High School, W-E-I-R, Weir High School in Weirton, West Virginia. Miss Betty is still teaching there. When her husband was in the hospital, which was way too frequently, she lived at the hospital with him. But she didn't miss a day of school. She was with him at the hospital, and she'd spend the night there and sleep there. She'd get up in the morning, and she'd take a shower, and she'd go teach her English classes at Weir High School. And then she came back to the hospital, and she was with her husband until she got a little bit of sleep. Then she did the same thing again, took a shower, went and taught school. At the first anniversary of Jim's passing, she posted about it being the first anniversary of his death. A friend of hers posted something on Facebook about her that really caught my attention. In praising Miss Betty, he said, Betty hoed her row all the way to the end. Boy, that's something to be proud of. Not everybody who says I do hoes their row all the way to the end. But if you're widowed, you did. It's not anything to be hesitant about mentioning. It's not anything to be ashamed of. As a matter of fact, it's something to be proud of. We live in a world where way too many people get married and don't hoe their row all the way to the end. Some people have to stop hoeing because something real sudden happens and they're blown away by some cataclysmic health event or some sort of an accident. And then there are people who do caregiving for a lot of years, and it can be exhausting. But people who are widowed have hoed their row all the way to the end. I want to suggest to you that when that happens to you, if you're married, nobody chooses it, but you can be proud of the fact. You hoed your row all the way to the end. Now, this is the Willis's hoe. I borrowed it. David's probably going to send me an invoice for the rental charge. He probably gave this to Dwina to hoe the garden. But that is the reason why that hoe is sitting here on the ministry table. What is it like to be widowed? Fred Colby. The greatest fear I had during the earliest stages of my grief was that I was going crazy. I was losing all control of my thoughts and that I might make decisions harming me, my family, and my friends, and that included suicidal thoughts. Miss Buffy, who lost her husband way too soon. 8 years ago, I married my best friend. 8 years ago, I never imagined my life would be the way it is now. I never dreamed that until death do us part of our vows would become my reality all too quickly. She's a teacher in a faith-based school. Every day, she called her husband at lunchtime. This one day, at the end of the conversation, she was concerned. She hung up the phone, she went to her car, started driving home, but it was a 45-minute commute. On the way, she called her dad, who was a law enforcement officer, and she asked her dad to go to the house because she was concerned about her husband. And her father found her husband dead. He had taken his life. Buffy was in her 20s, and they had a little boy, probably a couple years old. Miss Marilyn, up in the southeast part of Ohio, said, I cleaned my husband's room and I washed the last sheets that he slept on. So hard. I probably could have washed those sheets with my tears. When I lost my husband, Roy, it was as if I'd entered into another universe. I wasn't only grief-stricken, I was disoriented, terrified, and completely at a loss as to what I was supposed to do next. Although I wasn't on any medications, I felt like I was in a coma. I could hear what was going on. My body was present, but my mind was elsewhere. Miss Kim put it this way. The space inside of me, previously occupied by that passionate relationship, was strangely empty. I went from having someone think I was the most amazing person on earth to feeling invisible and vacant. Miss Catherine said, during the first year, it seemed like I was in a constant state of emotional agony. I would sit with a photo album in my lap and I would flip through pictures of a man I couldn't believe was actually gone. One woman said, who has a nursing background, I wanted to kill myself. Going to bed at night was so hard. I prayed that God would let me die. I wanted out of this life. One brother in the Lord in Middle Tennessee sent me something that he had written and permits me to share this publicly. A preacher, teacher. On August 16th of 2021, my heart was shattered by my sweet wife when she went home to be with the Lord. Now I live in a time that I do not understand. It is a lonely world of darkness that I no longer fit into. I have no one to care for but myself. The one I devoted myself to is gone. Frankly, my life stopped that day, he said later. This is not the way we planned it. My whole life was gone. And she was not supposed to die before me. We held hands constantly for 55 years. We thoroughly discussed everything we did. She laid out my clothes every morning so that we would match. Can you imagine what a struggle it was for that man? Getting up out of bed that first day. And for a few weeks. And for a few months. Having to pick out his own clothes. What do you think he thought about? Again, later he said, I eat out very little. Sunday was our day out to eat. Someone at church will ask me to join in, and I accept once in a while. I always go when the church has an eating event, but who do I sit with? If I sit with a family, their conversation does not allow me to join in because I really don't fit in. One lady said, we did everything together. We were married for 48 and a half years when a tiny germ, she calls it, COVID, took his life. I am struggling with extreme loneliness. The house is so quiet, it is no longer alive with joy. Some of you may know the name Robert Stapleton. They were missionaries for many years with Chamala Mission Hospital. Marcy Stapleton and Robert were married for 47 years. This was over 2 years after Robert passed away. I know I have to do my best each day, but it is hard at times. I never dreamed it would be this difficult. A lady that Cheryl Wayne and I met in her 50s in Florida, she texted me in April of 2020, and she permits me to share publicly this text. One day she shoots me this text. I was told by a family member that loves me that time will heal. I don't think that's at all possible. 33 years of my life with my husband sharing three children together was my whole world. I can't see past today and the pain is too much. Jackie over in Arkansas said, I wasn't a person anymore. Couples turned their backs on me. One brother said, I don't know what's going on. I just can't stop crying this afternoon. I'm just so lonesome. But when people are around, I just want them to leave so I can cry. Cheryl Wayne Lahan and I had a great visit leaving Knoxville and headed over this way. We stopped in Cookeville and visited with Brother Bill Goodpasture. And I love this post. He posted December of 2020 on Facebook. He said, a real marriage is about sharing, and the widow and widower no longer has someone to unload their life with. Children are great, friends are fine, but never the same as what a husband and wife share. Now here's the classic comment. When we were with him eating lunch just the other day, I said, Bill, I want to remind you of something that you posted. I said, I was really proud that you posted this. I said, it's classic. Here's the way he ended that post. Dear Janice, wish you were here. Glad you were there. Well, no offense to any widowed person who's here. Let me introduce you to my favorite widow. Her name is Millie. I was preaching in a gospel meeting in the Cincinnati, Ohio area, and the preacher came to me and said, Dean, I've got this 90-plus-year-old lady that wants to take you out on a date, a lunch date. I've been married for 41 years and had three daughters, and I know it's not safe for a man to say no to a woman. So Millie takes me out to lunch. Now, what was weird about this story is she took me to a Japanese restaurant, and I thought that was strange. Do 90-plus-year-old women eat at Japanese restaurants? I didn't think so. Willa Dean, what do you think? You're 90-plus. Would you eat at a Japanese restaurant?
Sure.
Okay. If I pay the bill. Okay. So Millie takes me to a Japanese restaurant, and I did the same thing with her I love to do with widowed people. I said, Millie, tell me your story. I knew she was widowed. And so she proceeds to tell me about this guy she was married to for 63 years. She told me about him. She told me about him as a father. She told me about their marriage. She told me about him getting cancer. She told me about her caregiving. She told me about him dying. And then she drops this conversational bomb. I was shocked. She said, but he was not my first husband. And I said, well, Millie, tell me about your first husband. She said, I was 19 years old. And we already had a child, a little over a year old, and I was pregnant with our second child. And she said, he was in General Patton's army in the Battle of the Bulge, and he died there. I'll quote you exactly what she said after she reported that. She said, I had him buried in France, a decision that to this day I regret. Ray Farmer was his name. After she told me that story, I reflected on that and I thought, wow, mid-1940s, 19-year-old female, pregnant, and already has a child over a little over a year old. I thought, how in the world did she navigate that situation? How in the world did she do that? It was 4 years later that she met the guy that she was married to for 63 years. After she told me that story, when I did workshops after that, sometimes I would call her because I got her phone number. As a matter of fact, she called me sometimes too. I called her and I would say, Millie, I told your story at this workshop at a certain place because I wanted her to know that her story had great inspirational power. Because the way I looked at her story is I thought, well, if Millie could do this in the mid-1940s as a 19-year-old kid, a girl pregnant with already having another child, if she can do this, then I can do this. Have you ever thought about how your life story could be somebody else's inspiration to help them through a stormy time in their life? Because they know that you learned to navigate, weather that storm, and came out on the other side. The interesting thing about this story is Millie passed away on July the 4th of 2018. I thought, how appropriate. At the Cold Harbor Church outside of Richmond, Virginia, I had a fella who heard that story, and he just happened to have access because of his interest in genealogy research. He got me a picture of Ray Farmer's marker in France, Millie's husband. No offense to you other widowed folks, she's my favorite. Sweet, sweet lady. The risk factors in regard to widowhood are basically three. Number one, you say I do. Number two, you stay hitched. Not everybody who says I do stays hitched. And if you're the one that keeps living, you're the one that's widowed. There are many, many ways bad marriages end. There is only one way good marriages end, only one, and that's death. Highly unlikely that you'll die together. Somebody is going to be left behind. And that's why I think it would be a real good thing in our local churches to teach about widowhood, not to the old folks, to the married folks, and to the kids who may be getting married in their near future. Because unless you say I do, you are never at risk of being widowed. I did not. Who would at 19? I certainly did not when I said I do. Think about the fact that I was placing myself at risk of being widowed. The thought never crossed my mind. Every married person is a prospective widowed person. I don't say that to scare married people. As a matter of fact, I say that for the same reason God has in His book numerous references to death. Why does God talk so much in His book about death? To help us with our life. You really can't live life to its fullest and the way it should be unless you understand the reality of death. It's the reality of death that helps us to live a wise life and a fruitful life and abundant life that Jesus came to provide. I'm convinced that the study of widowhood can help our families minister to their parents and grandparents better and can also help married couples appreciate their marriage more. The Maldonados in Alamosa, Colorado came to me Wednesday night at the end of that workshop. He is 80. At the time, and she was in her upper 70s. And they said to me, Dean, we are so glad that you came here. This workshop has really helped our marriage. I thought, man, at 80, haven't you figured this out yet? That's what I was thinking. He said, last night we went home and we talked about what we liked about being married to one another. And it created conversation in their marriage about the blessing that they were enjoying. Love those Maldonados in Alamosa, Colorado. Now, think out loud together with me. In our culture, what do we associate with widowhood? At least five. Let's come up with at least five. I've got a bunch, but let's get started with you giving me five. Give me five things that in our culture we typically associate with widowhood.
Loneliness.
Loneliness. It's almost always the first thing that's mentioned.
Old people.
Let's go with the loneliness thing here for a minute because I have a couple things I want to share with you. Anita, who's a member of the church in Middle Tennessee, said this, the loneliness is suffocating. She didn't say she was lonely. She said the loneliness is suffocating. Many of you know Kathy Lee Gifford from her time on NBC morning show, Today Show. She was married to Frank Gifford. Now, how many of you old geezers remember in black and white watching him as a halfback for the New York Giants? You're older than dirt. But it was great, wasn't it? He was good.
War number 16.
Pardon me?
War number 16.
War number 16. That's right. Great, great NFL football player. Now, they were both married before. Frank Gifford and Kathy Lee, both of them had previous marriages. They were married for 29 years. He died in 2015. One of the things I really appreciated about her is she was very frank, transparent about what it was like after Frank died. As a matter of fact, there was an article in the AARP magazine. Now, I know you're probably wondering why in the world would I be reading AARP magazine. I happened to pick one up, and I saw this article where they were interviewing her. And when she referenced her loneliness, she said she had, quote, crippling loneliness. She didn't say she was lonely. She said she had crippling loneliness. In the Tennessean, there is a YouTube interview. You can go on YouTube and you can ask for, in the search bar, probably Tennessean interview with Kathy Lee Gifford. In that interview that I watched, she was asked why she moved from New York City area to Franklin, Tennessee. She said, quote, I moved here because I was dying of loneliness. See, we're not talking about ordinary garden variety loneliness. We're talking about a different brand of loneliness. It is a big deal to deal with. One of the things that I wrote about in the third book I wrote, After the End Comes, was about loneliness after loss. It is a huge challenge. Give me something else. Can we come up with four more? Something we would relate to widowhood in our culture.
Poverty.
At the very least, a financial jeopardy. Now, we have in our country a Social Security system, and that is the perfect safety net, right? It can be a great challenge after the loss of a spouse. It can complicate your life. As a matter of fact, come back to bite you. I happened to talk to the wrong person on the other end of the phone about the Social Security system. And because of that, I made several trips from Murray City, Tennessee to Dyersburg, Tennessee, trying to straighten that mess out. The U.S. Census Bureau says that elderly women, now I'm not going to put a number on elderly, it was just, this is the way it was worded, elderly women. I don't know when the U.S. Census Bureau thinks you start being elderly. Elderly women who are widowed are 3 to 4 times more likely to live in poverty than elderly women who are married. Elderly women who are widowed are 3 to 4 times more likely to live in poverty than elderly women who are married. Even in the church, there can be financial jeopardy. We need to be aware of that. Somebody mentioned something else.
Being able to turn around and say, what do you think about this?
What do you think about this? Turn around and say that, and they're not even there. One of the things that is difficult to deal with is the absence of that person. You know, you probably have assigned seating in your house. Is that? I know you do at church. I'll tell you, when I go and visit a church, I make it a point to ask, is this anybody's seat? Because there's a sign. In Murray City, Tennessee, they not only have, they probably still do, they not only have assigned seating, they have assigned parking. I knew where everybody parked. Always the same place. They sat in the same place in the auditorium. Well, okay, the place where that person sat, what do you see now when that person's no longer with you? A harsh reminder. Via the scene of an empty chair. That's hard to deal with. And you're prompted to ask for feedback, and you don't get a response. You're dealing with the absence of the person. Yeah, Ben?
I share something with you. When I sit down at home, the left is a lazy boy, the last chair in which my first wife sat. To the right is a love seat, the last place my second wife sat. And when I look at those two places, I try to laugh as much as I can. I try to think about the good things that we did together. There are times of tears, but we need to learn to think about the good things, the memories that are still there. And in a sense, they're still there sitting with me.
One brother in Middle Tennessee carries a picture of his wife that he lost. That picture is about the size of this 3x5 card. It's in a frame that stands up. And when I visited with him over in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, before I went to Carnes, he had that picture of his wife right there. It can be a difficult challenge. And one thing we need to remember is that we need to deal with people not how we think they should be, but how they are. In Huntington, Tennessee, when I did a workshop there, there was a lady that came up to me and she said, I have been widowed 3 times. She could read my body language and she could tell that I was shocked when she said that. And here's what she said after that. She said, I had 3 wonderful Christian men in my life. She looked back more with a sense of gratitude than a spirit of grief at that point in her life. Can you name a couple of other ones that we might associate with widowhood? What?
Old people.
Old people. Jessica, how old were you when you're...
40,
and he was...
I went younger. He was 36. It didn't work. He died early.
You're an anomaly. Most women marry older men. So you were 40. He was 33 when he passed away?
36.
Okay. Emily, who lives in Salina, Tennessee, was awakened by her husband, her 36-year-old husband, having a heart attack. She's 34 at this point when this happens. She's 34. She's awakened by her 36-year-old husband having a heart attack. She pulls him off the bed because she has to have a hard surface, and she starts giving him CPR. She calls 911, and he's taken to the hospital. And a few days later, she posted the most powerful Facebook video I've ever seen. It was a Facebook video of her husband's body on a gurney being wheeled down the hallway of a hospital. A hallway that was lined by medical professional people, standing in silence, honoring him for his choice to be a donor. And you can hear on that video nothing but beep, beep, beep. She was 34 years old when her husband passed away. Many of you, I'm sure, remember Brittany, whose husband Bradford was up in Trenton, was in a terrible accident. They were only married a little over 1,300 days. She wrote a blog about her experience. She woke up one day and she was married, and before the sun went down, she was widowed, way before her time. I could take you to visit Cynthia up in Crockett County, whose husband went out and started welding, and he cranked up the welder. They're big cotton farmers up there in Crockett County. And he went out and cranked up the welder, and he was going to be welding on this truck that had a tank on it that was 75% diesel fuel and 25% fumes, but that was not the problem. There was a pinhole leak that he was unaware of in that tank. And so when he cranked up that welder, it blew up and blew his body out of the building. Cynthia ran and got a bunch of blankets and comforters wet and threw them on his body, and he was life-flighted to Memphis, and he died a couple of days later. You don't have to be old to be widowed. The most inspiring people that I've met, other than Millie Hartman, are young ladies and young men who have lost their spouses suddenly, way too early. Bill Simons is a guy in his early 40s who lives in the Canton, Ohio area. And he and his wife were members of the Hartville, Ohio church where I was for a number of years. One day his wife went to take a nap and she never woke up. When they were married, they adopted 3 special needs kids. And she died. It wasn't very long after that. Months after that, he had a stroke. He not only was in the hospital for a long time, he was in rehab for a long time. Here he is in the early 40s, stage of his life, 3 special needs kids. There are a lot of people who need a lot of help. For the sake of time, I'm going to ask you to think about some of these things. Can you imagine a person losing their spouse and actually feeling relief? What if your spouse was abusive? What if your spouse was an alcoholic? What if your spouse had been sexually unfaithful to you, maybe not just once, but on multiple occasions? Not all marriages are good. Some widowed people have had very bad marriages. Now, there can be a sense of relief, too, if you've done long-term caregiving and that person was a Christian and you know that person is better off. Now, you're going to be stuck with having to deal with the fact they've died, but there's a sense of relief that you're not having to caregive anymore. So if you're supposed to be grieving, when you feel more relief, how is that going to make you feel? You're guilty. Internal confliction. Now, what if you're a man like me, and you suffer from what I call overexposure to the female gender? I had a wife for 41 years and 3 daughters. You can't get out of that situation and be normal. I have a tendency to cry or to tear up much quicker than a typical male. Now, what if you lose your spouse and you don't cry? And typically, maybe in our thinking, we think of people grieving, crying. How's that going to make you feel if you're not crying? Guilty. So you're internally conflicted. What if you're crying and you can't stop crying and you start tearing up in the presence of somebody else? What do you say? I'm sorry. What do you have to apologize for? Nothing. Not a single thing. One of the best books that I read early on in my life when I was researching information about grief is this book by Doug Manning, Don't Take My Grief Away. I love the spirit of the title of this book. I don't care whether it's a daughter, a son, a sibling, a parent, don't let anybody take your grief away. And if you can't cry, that's okay. And if you can't stop crying, that's okay too, because that's you. And nobody has the right to take your grief away. We need to be very careful about telling people how to grieve because we're not them and we haven't experienced what they've experienced. It can be a real struggle. The heartache is incredibly difficult and you're going to have questions that are starting to bother you, and some of them may have to do with your faith. Again, we need to remember, we need to deal with people how they are, not how we think they should be. We need to work with them based on where they are. There is nothing wrong with admitting the fact you are struggling with your faith because of what you've experienced. Nothing wrong with that at all. As a matter of fact, you can take that burden and convert it into a blessing by struggling with that faith in the way that you should to end up having actually a stronger faith than you ever had before because you struggled. I have a daughter and a son-in-law both who are DPTs, doctors of physical therapy. Physical therapy patients often hate physical therapists because they make them feel pain. The reason why they need to feel pain, those patients, is because they need to get to a better place. They struggle physically to get to a better place. Whenever that man brought his boy to Jesus, had been foaming at the mouth and just flopping around, he said, "Lord, I believe." And then what did he turn right around and say? "Help my unbelief." You know, we're human. And I'm so glad God understands what a mess that we can be sometimes. If you struggle with your faith because of a great loss of a child or spouse or somebody else, you're human. Address the need. Deal with the questions. The loneliness is incredibly difficult to deal with, and you might have an identity crisis. If you were half of a whole, but the whole no longer exists, what are you? That is a struggle. And a lot of times, our marital status is what we permit to identify ourselves. I'm so-and-so's wife. I'm so-and-so's husband. But the marriage doesn't exist anymore. So you can struggle with your identity crisis. Financial jeopardy is not as uncommon as we'd like to think. And what you're having to deal with is forced change. You know, we're Americans. We live in a free country, right? We don't like to be told what to do. Well, the fact is, sometimes life forces us to deal with things that we don't want to have to deal with. And you have to deal with the absence of the person. And it may be very difficult to do that. The two most difficult places for a widowed person to go, and this is, I know way more widowed people than the normal person, but I'm not normal to start with. But I know a lot of widowed people, and this is universally something that virtually universally I've had shared with me. The two hardest places to go for a widowed person is number one, to bed, an in-your-face reminder that you are A-L-O-N-E every night. I could mention to you the name of a preacher that some of you would know that slept on the couch for months after his wife passed away. I've talked to men and women who've done that very thing. They didn't go back to bed in the bedroom for a long time afterwards. The second place that's real hard for a widowed person to go is to church. You would be surprised how many very salty tears are cried in church buildings because that person is no longer with you. That person had you as their number one priority. You had them as your number one earthly priority in human relationships. What I miss is being able to hold hands with somebody, with my wife, when we pray together in a corporate group. Where are you going to sit? Would you dare to sit at the same place? You know, the assigned seating thing? Would you dare sit at the same place? Or do you choose to go somewhere else? I'll tell you something that really tugs at me when I'm preaching. If prior to the time that I'm preaching, I find out about a person being widowed and they're in the audience and I see them sitting alone, that chokes me up. Because I got to thinking, could we at least sit with our widowed folks in worship? In Mission, Texas, when Cheryl Wayne and I were there, way down at the tip of Texas, there was this couple, this young couple, that told us about a mission that they have every Sunday when they come in. They come in, and what they do is they scope out widowed people. And they pick a widowed person, and they go and ask that widowed person, "Can we sit with you today?" Isn't that cool? A young couple. That's part of their every Sunday ministry. Sometimes it's a song that's sung. Somebody says something in a prayer. Or the preacher makes some reference to something that creates a grief trigger or a wave. Well, the dreams are not an uncommon thing. I'm talking about years after a person has died. That's not an uncommon thing. Are you always in control of your brain when you're awake? When you go to sleep, how much control do you have over your brain? That gray matter is going to go wherever it wants to, and you have no control. You are not going crazy. If you have a dream about that person you've lost, I mean years after that person has gone. I've talked to people, widowed people, who have dreamed about their mate 12, 15 years after they've lost their mate. It's just a normal part of the process of living with loss. And you have to deal with the silence. And the silence sometimes can be deafening. Those of you who have been married and those of you who are married, how many times have you said this or heard this? What in blue blazes are you doing now because of some noise? Or you say, could you be a little bit quieter? I'm trying to concentrate. Noise. A widowed person doesn't have that problem. The problem for the widowed person is silence. A lot of widowed people, the first thing they do in the morning is turn on their TV. I've met widowed females that say they turn on the TV when they get up in the morning and it runs the entire day until they go to bed. The emptiness that you feel is natural because that person helped to fill up your life, and now you have a dependence you didn't have previously because you were sharing your life and responsibilities, but now there are things that you're going to have to be willing to ask for help for and maybe even pay for. The stress level is off the chart. And who are we going to be angry with? There's a list. It's not just one. Who are you going to be angry at? Who? God. You're going to be angry with God. Well, let me mention something. T. Pierce Brown, back in the 1970s at the old Main Building, when the Gospel Advocate came out, there was a table and the Gospel Advocates were stacked there and anybody could come in and get a free, and because I was a cheap college student, I took one of those every week. Well, there was an article in there written by T. Pierce Brown. This was back in the late 70s. 1970s, not 1870s. And he put me on a journey where I started trying to understand the right perspective about the world I was living in. And here is a conclusion that I drew from that study. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. Now, I use the phrase God's will in the sense of, in that case, what he desires. Do you think God desired Eve to eat the forbidden fruit and then Adam to follow up? Do you think God desired for the world to become so wretched, so awful, that he had to have a universal flood? Do you think God wants domestic violence, alcoholics to get behind the wheel of cars and maim and kill innocent people? Not everything that happens in this world is God's will or desire, but in everything that happens, God has a will. Do you know what that is? For him to be glorified and you to be a blessing to other people. That's always his will. That's always his desire. This may be a shock to some of you, but God doesn't bless you so you can be happy. God wants you to embrace holiness. And if you embrace his holiness, you'll find happiness. What God is concerned about is him being glorified and us being a blessing to others. That's the way that God desires when we're prospering. Now, flip the coin. When we're suffering adversity, what's he desire? Exactly the same thing. For him to be glorified and us to be a blessing to others. That's always his desire. Everything that happens in this world is not necessarily what he wants. He's sovereign. He permits things to happen, but that doesn't mean he desires them to happen. Have you ever heard somebody who's gone through a terrible time in their life, and instead of blaming God, they blame the devil? When have you ever heard somebody say, I hate the devil. I hate what he's doing in my life. In the book of Job, who brought all that adversity into Job's life? It was the devil attacking him. I wonder if we really believe in the devil. That's what I'm curious about. Do we really believe that there is a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour? 1 Peter 5:8. Do we really believe what 1 John 5:19 says? The whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. Do we believe in the devil? We're so quick to blame God. Do we believe in the devil? By the way, the answer, the million-dollar question, The million-dollar question when we're struggling in our life and trying to live with an awful loss is not why. We think it is, but that's not. The million-dollar question is who. Who loves you more than anybody else? Who can provide for all of your needs more than anybody else? Who knows what's going on, not only around you, but inside of you? We know the answer to who. It's God. We may never know the answer to the question why. If you know the who, you can handle the what no matter why. No matter why. Literally, no matter why. If you know the who, you can handle the what no matter why. The who question is the million-dollar question. That needs to be our focus of attention when we're really struggling. You can be angry at the medical profession. They make mistakes, right? They don't know everything. That can happen. I can't help but think, sisters, in regard to Don Cooper, if they had kept him one day longer at Vanderbilt, but no, they shipped him home. Then he has this cataclysmic health event. He ends up dying. If they'd only kept him one day longer. How about getting mad at the person who dies on you? Now, isn't that crazy? Well, no, it's not. There's a lady named Jackie down in Florida. And she admitted to us that she would pound. Sometimes she'd get so aggravated and out of sorts when she took a shower, she'd pound the side of the wall of the shower and she'd say, "Why did you leave me? Why did you leave me?" Now, my personal thinking is her problem was she was from the state of Alabama. But Jackie rolls to the beat of a different drummer. But she just really struggled. And one of the ways that she got angry was she got angry at her husband for leaving. And that's not really uncommon. When you have anger, what should you do? You should deal with it. And if you're angry with God, especially, if you have a child who's angry with you, do you want them to stuff that? Or do you want them to confront you and just talk very transparently about why they're so angry with you? The latter is what creates intimacy later on. If we're angry with God, that's where we need to go. Well, again, our time is getting away from us. The worry and the fear is very natural because now you're A-L-O-N-E, and you're going to have some restlessness day, or it could be at night. In Chester, West Virginia, that was the first place I ever tried to do something like this. The elders permitted me 2 Sundays to teach the adult Bible class and preach. And when I was dealing with this, and the list was way shorter at that time, an 80-year-old guy came to me and he said, "I've got something I'd suggest you add to that list." A Christian brought that up. There are many, many more suicidal thoughts than there are suicides. Don't be naive in regard to those people that we sit and worship with tomorrow. Don't be naive. There may be people in that group who've thought the previous few days about suicide. Why? Because of life experience. The things that we experience in life can really cause us, our thinker and our feeler, to go places that we just never dreamed we would ever go internally. Well, we could even add more things, but let's explain why is this so difficult. It's the only relationship in the Bible, human relationship described in the Bible this way, one flesh. Now you stop and think about what marriage is all about. This is it. This is your prescription for a magnificent marriage. You can't have a perfect one, but you can have a magnificent one. When two people buy into the total giving of the total self for a total lifetime, they are going to be richly blessed. They're going to be burdened on occasion because there are two human beings living in a broken world, but there's the marital investment. Now when that goes up in smoke and you don't have that blessing anymore, it's going to create a lot of turmoil. Don't ever say to a person, "I know how you feel." There's a lot of things that are different. You take, for instance, not only are we different individually, relationships are different, families are different. How long a person has been married. There are people who have lost their mate after a few months. There are people who have been married for over 70 years. There are people who have families that are very talkative and very open. There are people who have families that are extremely dysfunctional. They don't talk about anything. Their communication pattern is negative and not positive and healthy. There are people who have a lot of faith. There are people who don't have very much faith. There are people who don't have any faith. Don't ever say to somebody, "I know how you feel." Somebody in the Widowhood Workshop Ministry has got a gift for all of you who are widowed, and it's a fork. As Deanna is there in that direction, where you can you circulate now? If you're widowed, as these peeps circulate, raise your hand because we want to give you a gift. Girls, let me have one. Go, go. We're running out of time. Go. Now, if you want to lose weight, you can eat with it. Okay? Pretty small. That's not the reason I'm giving it to you. Don't be insulted. Okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take this fork home with you, and I want you to lay it somewhere where you will see it every day. I've had some people say that they lay it on the kitchen counter. Some people lay it on their nightstand. Some people lay it wherever they watch TV. But here's what I want you to think about when you see this fork. Now, when you pick up a fork, what have you decided to do? Eat. Then with a fork in your hand, what else are you deciding? What to eat. Now, was your mama like mine? Did they tell you that story about the starving children in China? You need to eat all the stuff on your plate? Okay. Well, mothers, I don't know how old mothers think of that story. You decide that you're going to eat. You decide what you're going to eat. What else are you deciding? When you're going to eat, what else are you deciding? How much you're going to eat, when you're going to stop. Okay, at every point, at somewhere in a person's grief journey, we've got to realize we've come to a fork in the road, and we've got to start making some decisions. Now, early on is no time to be making decisions, big decisions. As a matter of fact, that Grieving Brain book, and you can Google this too, widow brain. There's a chemo brain, there's a widow brain. In other words, it's basically an excuse not to think very good. Okay? You got to realize that early on, you're going to have to deep grieve. And here's the way I would picture it. There's a chair, and you're sitting in front of a closed door. Now, not only is it a closed door, that door has been slammed shut. It wasn't quietly shut, it was slammed shut. And all you can do is stare numbly. You're just numb. You stare at that door and you can't believe that door's shut. And you grieve. You're just shocked. That shock is normal, even if you've seen that person decline over years. When it happens, it's still a shock. You probably, at some point, you get up and you reach for the knob because you wonder if you can open it again. But it's locked. Slam shut door, locked. You will not ever be able to walk through that door. That is a harsh thing to experience. Deep grieving is necessary early on, for as long as you need to, in whatever way you need to, and don't let anybody tell you how to do it or how long to do it. That's your grief. You do it in whatever way is helpful. And by the way, if you need professional help, seek it and do not be ashamed of it. Professional counselors can be a great help to people who are struggling mightily with great losses in their life. But at some point in time, you've got to decide, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? That's up to you. You don't have a husband or a wife to talk about that with, but you've got to decide, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? You did not die. You may feel dead, and let's be honest about it, some may want to die, but you've not died. There are three mottos of the Widowhood Workshop Ministry. One of them is, don't die until you're dead. Another one, don't waste your pain. Take your story, whatever your lost story is, use it for the glory of God by helping other people. And remember, you can and you will, if you choose to, with the Lord's help, you'll be able to live with your loss in a way that glorifies God and helps other people. Deanna, do you have all the cards? This is not all the material, but I promised I would quit on time, and I'm already 2 minutes late. I wish I had more time. Oh, look at that. Okay, Emma Kate, come over here. Okay. Riley Brooke, come over here. Okay, Riley Brooke, Riley Brook, you dig in there and see. Now, the name that she pulls out, close your eyes, don't cheat. I know you know Rosemary, don't pick it out just for her. Okay, what do we have for a name? Yell it out good and loud.
Don Shull.
Where? Okay, now Don, you come up here. You've got a choice of three things. Now, here is a great book, Undistracted Widow, Living for God After Losing Your Husband or Wife. And then here's the other book, A Grace Disguised, a great book written by a person who experienced gut-wrenching loss. You can have one of these two books, or you can pick a prize out of the golden chest of prizes. Don, okay, now make sure you get a picture of him with the book. Okay, now, we've got this other book, A Grace Disguised, and Riley, pick out another name.
Joan Smith.
Now,
I'll take that book.
You don't want something out of the golden chest of prizes? Do you know?
Billy wants that book.
Okay. Oh boy, you women. You're so strategic. Okay. It is a really neat book.
Thank
you. Yeah, really neat book. Okay. I wish that we had more time, but we don't. And I hope tomorrow that you're able to come here. And if you're from another congregation and you come here, we're not going to squeal on you. As a matter of fact, if you need an absentee slip, we'll fill one out tomorrow. At Bible class, we're going to be talking about praise the Lord no matter what. That's not always an easy thing to do. And I will confess, there was a time in my life that I didn't want to praise the Lord. And I'll be very honest with you about it. In the sermon study time, we're going to study Psalm 31, a beautiful, powerful psalm written by David when he was a mess. He gives us some insight into how that we ought to respond when we're just overwhelmed with our life experiences. Sunday night, we're going to be talking about a number of things that used to be titled Marriage, Especially After Loss. The first few years of this ministry, I could not deal with that subject. I wasn't about to do it, and I refused to do it. After several questions were asked, I thought, I've got to do it. I've got to have some sort of session where we talk about marriage after loss. But you can't talk about marriage after loss unless you talk about marriage. So we're going to be talking about love, marriage, loss, grief, contentment, and the possibility of having another relationship after losing your spouse. When have you ever been in a Bible class where that kind of stuff has been discussed? I think we need to talk about that openly so that some can be prepared for that experience down the road. And don't ever say, you're cursing yourself if you say this. I'll never get married again. That's like the 16-year-old girl that's trying to comfort her father, saying, Dad, don't worry, we're just friends. And then he becomes the father of the bride. There is life for the father of the bride after the wedding. It's called poverty, but at least it's life. Thank you very much.